Justin Landon, and I am the host of Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am joined today by Sam Morgan and Lisa Rogers, who are both literary agents with Jabberwocky. Lisa, like me, grew up in California. Unlike me, she's from the North, which is like beyond the wall in fantasy terms. After college, she attended NYU's Summer Publishing Institute and joined the Jabberwocky team a few months later. She previously worked at San Francisco / Sacramento Book Reviews and Barnes & Noble. She interned at Levine Greenberg Rosten Literary Agency and has read submissions for Lightspeed. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Sam is the native of North Carolina, which means he has bad taste in barbecue. He went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill with bad taste in basketball, too. Before joining Jabberwocky in late 2012, Sam worked throughout New York City as a television critic, pizza guy, and several other glamorous positions. He's active in the New York comedy scene at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater and is reportedly a nerd. What's up, Sam?
Hey, Justin.
Are you okay with my comments on barbecue and basketball?
I know what good taste is.
Well, clearly you have good taste in books, right? So I guess we'll give you some credit on the book end, but I can't do it on barbecue.
All right. Well, my gut tells me differently.
Fair enough. All right. So although you are both qualified to talk about a lot of things, some of which we might get into later, depending on how long we talk about what I'm going to make you talk about, we're here to talk about the new television show on Fox, Gotham, which is like a cop show, but with Batman. And before I bring up all the various issues I have with it, I just wanted to kind of get a brief first impression from both of you on, did you like it? Did you not like it? Where are you at with Gotham? And Lisa, why don't we hear from you first?
I actually am on the positive side for reactions. I'm not especially steeped in Batman lore or superhero lore, so I didn't have a lot of things that I needed to reevaluate in terms of backstory and fitting all the pieces together. It's like, I know who the major villains are, so seeing them pop up, I'm like, oh, I know who that guy is, and I know who that guy is, and I know who that chick is. So I was happy to follow along with this Batman police procedural.
What about you, Sam?
Well, as you mentioned, I used to be a television critic, and I was really looking forward to this. You know, it has everything I should supposedly like in a television show. It's, you know, superheroes, it's a procedural, it's on Fox. They generally do good genre television shows.
Until they cancel it.
Yeah. But I watched the episode, and at the end, I was thoroughly bored and disappointed with it.
Were you angry?
I wouldn't go so much as angry, because, I mean, it is television, and you shouldn't get angry at something as inconsequential as television, but, you know, just kind of disappointed.
Well, and I suppose I fall somewhere between the two of you. One of the things that was really bothering me throughout the show was, good criminy, how many Easter eggs did they have to drop?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, Lisa, it's interesting that you are not so up on your Batman lore, and I'd be curious, like, how many Easter eggs you picked up on. I mean, I picked up on maybe 5 or 6, but I hear there were, like, a dozen. Were they tripping you up as you were watching as kind of somebody who's not super Batman-y?
I actually did some internet research afterward because, like, I recognized Penguin because they called him Penguin. I recognized Ivy because her name is Ivy.
Did you get the Enigma thing about the Riddler?
No, but I was actually thinking, oh, his name is, I thought they had called him Enigma, and I'm thinking, like, the World War II
code
machine? That can't be right, but, like, I knew something was odd with that name. Mm-hmm. So after going through, like, the internet and seeing what people were saying and pointing out the Easter eggs, I'm like, oh, of course the girl in the beginning is Catwoman, because I've been thinking, like, what's up with this girl? But other than introducing Catwoman first, I didn't find the Easter eggs, they didn't throw me out of the narrative, because I was watching it more along the lines of James Gordon and Batman, and I assume the important people will pop up eventually.
See, they kind of ruined it for me with the Easter eggs because it got in the way of telling a good story. Like, they were so worried about fan service that, you know, trying to shoehorn in Poison Ivy, the Penguin, the Joker, all these detectives and stuff, that they forgot to tell a good story.
It was almost like they were doing a dramatic representation of the cast list that you're going to see throughout the series.
Yeah, so it was almost a dramatis personae as opposed to like a first episode. And I don't know about you two, but when I crack open a book and there's a dramatis personae, I am already skeptical.
I usually skip those when I see them because I figure I don't know who any of these people are. I don't care. And then as I am introduced to characters through the various chapters, I'll go back to the beginning to remind myself who they are and how they relate.
Yeah, if Brandon Sanderson doesn't have one in Way of Kings and Words of Radiance, I don't need one for a television show like this.
Right, yeah, exactly. Putting aside some of the fan service for a minute, we'll come back to it because I think there's a lot more to talk about there, but I think you can look at it as two kinds of shows. On the one hand, it's clearly heavily relying on noir tropes, noir hard-boiled tropes. And then on the other hand, it's got this really strong sort of police procedural thing going on. And if you look at it as just a police procedural, which we see on television, I mean, how many are there? A dozen? I mean, Hawaii 5-0, CSI, NCIS, NCIS New Orleans, NCIS LA, NCIS, you know, Prague. there are plenty of police procedurals. And as a police procedural, this is not an exceptional show.
Well, the hard thing about this show is that it wants to be a procedural, but at the same time have this, like, mythology going for it at the same time. You know, it's trying to do like the X-Files did, but from the start. And I think, really, that's the only critically adored show that's been able to produce such procedural elements with, like, their Monsters of the Week, but also carry forth this, like, big mythology. And, you know, it kind of stumbled out of the blocks.
I think that this first episode as a police procedural was not the best police procedural episode that I have ever seen. However, I was intrigued enough by the characters and by just the general premise that I'm willing to watch another episode to see if over the course of like episodes 2 and 3 that it finds its feet as a police procedural as well as a Batman offshoot program.
Did you find that some of the contrivances of the show, like the whole case hinging on whether or not somebody happened to have shiny shoes in his closet, or the wonderful plot contrivance of the Penguin being shot on a pier with a guy only 10 feet away who realized that he did not realize that he actually shot the guy or did not actually shoot the guy. I mean, it just felt like they were throwing up these plot contrivances really with no thought for or any care for whether or not they were going to stick out like sore thumbs. I mean, it was really like, let's just show the characters. Let's get people hooked on Batman and we'll worry about the rest later.
Well, you also got to remember, this is a show that eventually is going to have its savior dress up like a bat and stalk the night through criminals and have criminals that are like have a fetish for riddles and dress like a penguin. So it's going to be kind of campy and stupid like that. I think that it goes like, it was just, it gets even deeper, like, than just having, you know, shooting a guy on the pier. Like, you remember the scene where Harvey comes out after having the big argument with the captain or whatever, and he's sitting there talking to James Gordon, and he's like, you know, you're a war hero, and your dad was a great DA in Gotham City. Like, that's just bad storytelling. That's telling us instead of showing us. And why weren't we in that big shouting match to begin with? Why did we have to come out in late, like 2 seconds later, and have him just tell us these facts with some incredibly awkward info dumping?
I do have to agree with Sam about the info dumping in that particular scene. But when it comes to the plot contrivances, because this is, in essence, a genre show. I was okay with the shiny shoes and the shooting scene, because it does remind me of something that you would find in a comic book. It worked for me because of the source material.
Yeah, I get that, and I get when Sam says it's campy, just kind of roll with it. But at the same time, we're not talking about 1960s Batman, where the camp is the point. This show is at least attempting to bring all of the Batman grit to the television series. And by folding in these police procedural items, I feel like they're sort of setting up an expectation that this show's going to make sense to a modern viewer.
Time, like, they didn't have time to do that. You know, they had to fit in, you know, the cameos from Poison Ivy and all the other villains that are going to show up. I'm sure if they only focused on the Penguin, which I feel was the big villain or whatever for the season, that, you know, you would have had a chance to, like, get more realistic with the actual crime. Like, as it was now, we had to have 45 seconds devoted to some stand-up comedian that may or may not be the Joker. And whereas, you know, had they cut that part, we could have, you know, gotten more CSI-y with the crime.
Lisa, although I know you're not terribly familiar with the Batman mythos, you're at least familiar with the general parts of it. And I thought it was interesting that they chose in this show to be extremely loyal to certain parts of the Batman backstory, like particularly the death of Batman's parents. Like, they're pretty true to, like, that aesthetic, the, you know, the couple walking through the alleyway, getting shot, like, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's very true to that part. But then we see things like, this is super nitpicky, the Batgirl is Barbara Gordon. Like, we all know that Batgirl is Barbara Gordon, and that is not typically Jim Gordon's wife. Typically, even like his daughter, and now it's his wife. And there are going to be other instances like that. With a show that's doing so much fan service, how do we reconcile which tropes are going to do and which tropes are not going to do? To me, it's like either you're in for fan service or you're in for like just telling a new, fresh take on Batman. I don't know what this is.
That is a very good question. And it might be that they don't quite know yet either, and that they're waiting to see who their fan base is and kind of tailor it that way. Kind of like they tried to do a lot with this pilot, and I'm willing to give them a couple more episodes to figure out the police procedural part of it. So maybe in that way they're also trying to figure out what it is that the show is actually about as they're doing it.
And, I mean, in terms of, like, changing up, like, Barbara Gordon and stuff, I think that it's more, you know, they had to have
a love interest.
Well, a love interest, but also a female character. You know, if you're going to make Poison Ivy a 10-year-old girl, you have to have someone there that's of the lady persuasion.
Well, there's Fish Mooney and the...
Who was an invented character.
And the lurking Catwoman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are several women. Although I would say that the lurking Catwoman is a little bit young compared to, say, Barbara. I would still put her in the girl category.
Well, I'm just the kind of geek that doesn't care too much if they change up part of the canon for the show, because I think, you know, comic books are, you know, it's not a Marvel statue there. It's a clay figurine that you can bend and mess with and make it your own thing.
And there's a tradition in comic books as well of just reinventing the backstory as you need to.
Yeah.
The retcon.
Exactly.
One of the things that you mentioned, sort of the fact that Ivy and Catwoman and Bruce Wayne are all of an age within striking distance of one another. You know, Catwoman's probably 14 or 15 and Batman's 12, and I call him Batman, but Bruce Wayne is 12 and and Ivy is like 10, right? So they're all of an age together. And so that's what I'm very interested in seeing is whether or not that becomes its own set of storylines among this younger audience, sort of almost like a young adult story. And then you've got these older characters like the Riddler and the Penguin and Gordon and the Joker and Fish Mooney and Falcone and all these other adult villains. Like, how those two worlds intersect is actually, I think, going to be one of the most fascinating parts of the show.
That would be extremely fascinating.
Well, I think that sounds great. I don't think that's what they're going to do. Like, I think it's going to be Jim Gordon trying to figure out who shot Thomas and Martha Wayne, and it's just going to be incredibly, like, boring. Because, you know, in television, it's really hard to work with child actors. I mean, from the practical side, you can't use them as much. You can't, you know, there's all sorts of weird laws about paying them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And not to mention the fact that they grow up way quicker than, you can show on screen. Like, take, Walt from Lost, for example. Like, you have to work with some weird stuff there. So, like, I think that'd be cool if they did that. Do I see it happening? No.
That being said, I continue to be interested in Gordon's storyline. Like, I'm okay with him being the lead in the show.
Well, and how do we feel about him being this sort of white knight? I mean, they've set up like this very interesting setting where essentially he is the only good person, with the exception of these two random other police officers and his girlfriend. I mean, everybody else is painted dark, dark shades of gray or all the way into the black. And we have this basically this white knight. To me, that feels a little bit boring just in its basic setup.
You know, that's part of the arc they're going for with his character. You have this lawful good character in a city that's just, you know, at best anyone is, you know, chaotically good. You know, no one's ever, if they even rise to that level. But I think that, you know, from a character standpoint, that'll be interesting, seeing someone of such a pure heart being faced up against, like, what kind of values is he willing to sacrifice in order to do something for the greater good.
I agree with everything Sam just said.
Heck yeah, I'm smart. But, I mean, it'll also be good because eventually, you know, this is Gotham, and eventually Batman is gonna have to show up. And when he does, it'll actually be, like, a really big sense of relief because, like, finally here's someone who can, you know, make the sacrifices that Jim Gordon can for the greater good and actually get some good stuff done.
So that's the elephant in the room, right? So right now we have a television show that is able to be serious to some degree because it's, or at least connect with a mainstream audience because it's not, there's no comic book character right now, right? It's a police procedural set in a made-up city that looks a lot like New York and feels a lot like New York, and it's this thing. But we have this big elephant in the room, which is Batman. And
right.
How long can this show survive without Batman? And we've never really seen a superhero show on network television that can survive being a superhero show.
Really a superhero show, because if the show were about Batman, it would be called Batman. It's called Gotham. So it has superhero elements, but I think you could make the strong argument that it's not actually a superhero movie and might escape that superhero TV show curse.
Yeah, I mean, like, S.H.I.E.L.D. is doing really well, and that has superheroes in it. You know, superhero cartoons work pretty well all the time as well. But, you know, I think, honestly, they should have had Batman in it from the beginning. Like, I know this is going way far off canon and retconning it, but can you imagine how cool it would have been had you see Thomas and Martha Wayne about to get shot, and then Batman jumps in on them? Like, instead of wondering who killed them, it's actually Jim Gordon trying to figure out who Batman is, and we don't know as the audience because Bruce Wayne hasn't been turned into the Batman.
So a time-traveling Batman?
That's getting a little too crazy. Let's stick to some reality here with a guy with a flying bat suit. Like, that to me would have been way better, and, you know, just let me completely change this show for a second. But, yeah, I mean, if you're going to exist in a world with superheroes, might as well have them in there from the beginning.
I want to talk a little bit about a couple of problematic things I think that popped up in the first episode. The first of which was this very awkward scene in the beginning where Jim Gordon rescues the police department from this, you know, rogue who wants his pills, and his dirty partner comes up and says, you know, it's basically this, like, you gotta put down a bad guy when you see him. You just shoot first and ask questions later. Which, given the events of the recent months with police violence and brutality, that scene came off really badly to me. Did either of you feel that, experience that as you watched it?
My experience with that was just, it was just very awkwardly done. I don't know, just, it felt like the actors hadn't yet settled into their roles and the dialogue wasn't quite right, but I did not get the real world tie-in like you did.
I mean, I kind of have that problem with, like, a lot of cop shows in general, just, you know, having some basic understanding of the law. Most television procedurals take way many liberties when it comes to, you know, the due process and stuff. But, yeah, with everything that's happened in the past few months, it did paint a little bit of a somber, darker picture on undertone of that, but, you know, this was shot and written months ago. Not that that's really any excuse, but it's just unfortunate timing all around.
The other thing that kind of agitated me was the way that Bruce Wayne is being handled in the aftermath of his grief. And as he is grieving over the loss of his parents and trying to come to grips with life without his parents, at the end of the show, Gordon comes to his house and he's standing on a ledge, seemingly about to jump. That's what it looks like. And Gordon questions him on it, and it becomes this sort of like, I'm just testing myself. And his guardian, Alfred, is just sort of like, yeah, well, you know, that's what happens. And it's just like, what? Like, can we have a discussion here about a young person grieving and doing all of the things that we would associate with suicide or self-mutilation? And that bothered me.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, you're absolutely right, but I sort of see, like, my favorite interaction between Bruce and Alfred was when, you know, right after that scene, Alfred tried to say something and Bruce, like, shuts him down. Because you got to remember, Alfred is still an employee of Bruce. And, you know, Bruce might do stuff like that, but Alfred can't really do anything about it. Like, at least that's my understanding of the canon. Like, I know Alfred sort of takes on this fatherly role to him, but, you know, I think Bruce is the, you know, kind of spoiled one percenter kid out there acting out without any restraints right now.
I wonder if the writers had thought of other ways to have Bruce enter that scene instead of looking like he's going to jump off the building and making viewers wonder, oh my god, is this where Batman dies? Or if they had considered other options to get across that, you know, I'm not grieving, although the audience doesn't know that at the moment, in a traditional way, but I'm testing myself to overcome my fear. Like, I just...
It was a really hot scene, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just talking about it now. I'm still working through how I feel about it.
Yeah, there was also a scene in the previews, you know, the next week on Gotham. There was this scene where he's holding his hand over a flame and obviously dealing with his pain response. And again, like, although I understand what they're trying to do, it's like Batman becoming Batman. But by the same token, this is a show watched by children, presumably, although I would question that. But I'm sure kids are watching it because it's about Batman. And you're showing this young person inflicting pain on themselves to deal with grief. And that is something that we have really talked a lot about in our society. And the show doesn't really seem to be aware of that fact, at least not yet. And that worries me.
Yeah, that is troubling. My, just listening to you talk, my first reaction was, the show is called Gotham. The show is following James Gordon. So I'm almost questioning, why are they focusing on Batman?
Well, You have to.
I understand, but it is a show about Gotham. If they wanted to do a show about Batman, but that was my first thought. But I agree that this showing us images of this teen grieving by inflicting pain on himself is quite troubling.
Sam's like, yeah, but it's Batman.
It's Batman.
Yeah.
All right, so that's kind of Gotham. I think we kind of hit Gotham pretty good there. What's interesting is that Gotham is now, a minute ago I said that superheroes haven't really been done on TV or haven't really been done successfully on TV, but that's changed in the last 12 months or 18 months or 2 years, whatever it is. I mean, we've started to see Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Arrow. Admittedly, that's on the CW, so we can question whether it's successful or not, but it's out there.
It is, and it's actually a pretty good show. Like, I'm enjoying it.
So we're seeing more superhero shows on television, and I want to ask why we're seeing that. I mean, but putting aside the notion that, like, well, it's been successful on film, and so that's why we're seeing it on television, I know that's the actual answer. But is there perhaps a deeper reason why we're becoming more infatuated with superhero shows and more willing to tolerate them on television, Lisa?
I think perhaps that the audience is tired of seeing all of the awful things that are going on in the news media right now, and the television studios know this or have somehow figured this out, and they figure we should give the audience something a little more hopeful, a little less evil things are happening, and more people are stopping the evil things from happening.
Sort of agree with you there, but I think just genre fiction in itself is becoming more popular.
Also, that was Game of Thrones.
I mean, think about it. Game of Thrones is the biggest television show in the world right now, and it's based on this huge series that came out, what, 25 years ago? Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was originally, like, what, 1990?
Something like that.
Yeah.
You know, George Martin writing in 1919.
Yeah. So I think that's, you know, and you have, like, the revival of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
You have Outlander finally coming to television. I mean, Lost debuted 10 years ago. And I just think it's more of, you know, people are stretching the boundaries of what we can show visually on television. And the way to do that is through genre. And the way to, you know, tell kind of deep personal stories is through superheroes. And it's just what's happening.
And to piggyback off what Sam was saying, the computer graphics that you can get in movies and in television for much cheaper than in the 80s and 90s or even the early 2000s allows for you to have more science fiction and fantasy-based television shows done well as opposed to done really, really terribly.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, the sci-fi fantasy genre is becoming more accepted by the mainstream population, in part due to Game of Thrones. And I think those two
things... I think it's further back.
Definitely further back, but I see a lot of Game of Thrones books just on the subway.
Well, think about the most modern superhero movie. You have... I think it starts with X-Men, the original X-Men, which was, you know, early 2000s. Then you have Spider-Man coming out. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's
Spider-Man
been,
twice.
Yeah, like, we're in the second.
And you have them all working together, and then you have the Avengers.
Yeah. And so, it's over a decade, and about time, and it's, you know.
So it's just there's a cultural awareness that genre fiction can be really great and can now finally be done well in a visual media.
Yeah, so it trickled down to TV.
I'm pretty sure if the two of you don't mention True Blood, your boss is going to throw something at you.
So. Wait, what's True Blood?
who wrote that? But yes,
wait.
True Blood has contributed to all of this.
Wait, True Blood's on sale on Amazon right now? Are you kidding? What? That's amazing.
It's interesting that you mention that, Sam, but but it actually ties into my question, which is just sort of like, I wonder if television executives are starting to realize something about not just about superheroes and genre fictions appealing to the masses, but also the fact that fandom or geeks or nerds or whatever however you want to define them, are also seemingly within that adult demographic far more likely to go out and buy crap after the series is done. I mean, Game of Thrones obviously doesn't make most of its money on ad sales because there are no ad sales. So they're making most of their money in everybody buying the DVDs, you know, like buying the DVDs, buying the other merchandise. I mean, Game of Thrones is monetized in a different way. And so I wonder, too, if they're seeing that and seeing the eagerness that people are going out and purchasing the DVDs and purchasing the seasons and all of that.
Well, no, see, True Blood is different since it's HBO. And HBO, you know, is completely subscriber-based. So the more people they have watching the show, the more people they're going to keep buying HBO. Like, HBO doesn't care about the books. I mean, we can probably shouldn't speak too candidly about that. But, I mean, I know they don't. And the fact, but with something like Gotham, you have people that, you know, I'm not so sure it's that they'll go out and buy more stuff, it's that they'll be loyal.
Yeah.
And they will come back again and again and watch it and then watch the commercials that are in between it.
Mm-hmm. Cause we, you know, cause we're obsessed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, I hate, the second new episode of Doctor Who this year, but I'm still gonna watch every episode of Doctor Who that airs. And
I think I am the only person in the entire genre community who has not seen a single Doctor Who episode.
Lisa, oh my God.
Lisa, you and I are soulmates who hate Doctor Who because actually I don't hate it. I just never watched it. I just don't care.
Yeah, no.
I am so disappointed in you guys right now.
So, all right, Sam, pitch us. Why should we be watching Doctor Who?
Are you serious right now? I've been preparing for this answer or this question my entire life. All right, Doctor Who is the greatest show on television. And I say greatest very specifically as a term or as a fan of great writing, because Doctor Who as a show only needs like very few elements for it to work. You have to have the Doctor. He has to be an alien. You have to have a TARDIS and you have to have a sonic screwdriver. And generally you have to have a human companion in order for someone else to relate to. You need those five things and you can have any sort of story you want taking place at any location throughout time and space. And, you know, with that sort of freedom, it's incredible. Like, you can have, like, Monster of the Week horror movies. You can have slapstick comedy. You can have a retelling of Robin Hood. And, you know, you can have a dinosaur on a spaceship. And it's incredible. So, like, for one show to have been doing all that for 50 years is a testament to its greatness.
See, you say that Doctor Who is so broad and will appeal to so many people on so many different levels. I'm just like, how do they keep a loyal fan base? Because if one episode is horror monster of the week, another episode is time traveling dinosaurs, like how, and another episode is Robin Hood, how do you keep the people who only want to see the time traveling dinosaurs?
Because there is like, you know, there's like this theme that runs through it, like the Doctor himself, Craig Ferguson, you know, of the Late Late Show on CBS, he's a huge Doctor Who fan, and he summed it up perfectly by going, the Doctor isn't, you know, he's not a warrior. He's someone that fundamentally believes that love and compassion triumphs over brute force and cynicism. And so having that, like, fundamental theme throughout every episode as someone who goes exploring and constantly finds himself in trouble, that the Doctor promotes that, and that sort of optimism and sense of love throughout finding that throughout the universe, that's what you find.
Hmm.
And that's why you guys should watch Doctor Who.
That was pretty good, but you lost me at Sonic Screwdriver.
All right, well, like 10 minutes ago.
Just because I don't know and because I'm curious, Sonic Screwdriver, like, I'm sorry, like, that just sounds dumb.
I mean, and that's like a holdover from like the campiness of the 60s and 70s when the show was still finding itself. And it's just really just Batman has his utility belt, Superman has his laser vision, and
Superman
stuff.
Has a lot of stuff.
Yeah, Superman has a lot of stuff. And it doesn't break things. A screwdriver doesn't break anything. It fixes things.
I've broken some stuff with a screwdriver.
So, well, you should be given a screwdriver.
Why is that, Sam?
You will break things.
What does the sonic screwdriver does other things besides screw them?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a, you know, it's not an unlimited powerful tool, but like, you know, if a door is locked, it can generally unlock it. It can do medical scans. You know,
you say sonic screwdriver, and I'm thinking of Sailor Moon's scepter that allows her to transform into Sailor Moon.
No, I mean, this is an actual tool that they can use and stuff, you know.
So it's a little bit like the Star Trek tricorder, but with a laser element?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay.
It's a high-tech Leatherman or Swiss Army knife is what you're telling me.
Ah, yeah, better
exactly. Knife. It's a Gallifreyan Swiss Army knife.
Well, Sam's taste in television is questionable now, Lisa, but is there a show out there that you love that you would like to encourage people to watch?
TV show that I love in the genre? Not that's coming readily to mind. I really do like police procedurals, so I suppose that kind of relates back to the Gotham topic. I really enjoyed Longmire on A&E, although A&E just canceled it. So, you know, that said, for me, in terms of main characters with fancy tools, I also really appreciate Archer.
Yeah, Archer's a genre show.
Is it really? It's more James Bond than...
But, by thrilling.
Yeah. But I tend to consume more books than TV.
That's fair. You get paid when you consume books.
Yeah.
Theoretically. So on that note, before we wrap up here and I send you all on your merry way into the New York City subway or some other walk into the mean streets of New York, y'all are both literary agents, and I'm sure you've got some stuff coming out from your various clients. Is there anything hot coming out that people will want to pay attention to?
My client, Erin Lindsay, her first fantasy novel is coming out September 30th. It's called The Bloodbound, published by Ace Rock. And it's a heroic fantasy with strong romantic elements, and it's so amazing.
And Justin, I think you know what I'm about to promote. We have Robert Brockway's The Unnoticeables coming out from Tor in next July that we just had the big cover reveal for. It's dark and gritty and horrifying and incredibly fun and beer drinking and hilarious. But I also have Ari Marmel's Hollow Point coming out next May, which will be the second Mick Oberon job. And then his final Wittershins adventure comes out in February. That's Covenant's End.
Very nice. I have actually read both the Erin Lindsay book and the Robert Brockway book. They're both great. I actually think the Erin Lindsay book, I think I mentioned this when I was at your offices a couple weeks ago, was that it reminded me a ton of Elizabeth Moon's fantasy, especially her early stuff, which bodes very well, I think, for readers. Obviously, Elizabeth Moon's a rock star.
Yes.
Yeah, she is.
And another one of your clients, one of your agents.
And another one of our clients, yeah.
And the Brockaway book is bizarre. I mean, it's kind of like it's very horror, but it's also got this super cool New York punk vibe going on to it, and I'll be very interested to see how that book fits within the marketplace, because it's got a little Robert Jackson Bennett, it's got a little bit of Laird Barron horror motif, so it's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, it's weird and wonderful, and I think it's the shakeup the market needs. There really isn't anything quite like it out there.
Thank you both so much for being here and taking time out of your commute home.
Thank you for having us.
This has been Rocket Talk.